From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
But I think that the United States ought to realize that China right now is inherently unstable, and that's why the government is so paranoid right now. That's why they would arrest someone like me, who was covering a peaceful protest, and immediately deport me out of the country.
The haves and have-nots of China. Tonight, PBS will air a documentary on China, but what they won't say is that almost all of the film crew was arrested. But first, Band-Aids versus Radical Corporate Transformation. Today, a roundtable discussion on how to crack down on corporate crime. We'll look at proposals by the Democrats and Republicans in Congress, and then proposals by the people. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners around the country.
We're going to move right to our top story, which is two Palestinian suicide bombers killed one Israeli and two immigrant workers, as well as themselves, on Wednesday in Tel Aviv. The bombing left more than 40 people injured. Many of the wounded were foreign laborers replacing Palestinian workers barred from entering since the outbreak of fighting. The community in that area of Romanians, Nigerians, Filipinos, and Thais. The bombing came only a day after a bus ambush that left eight settlers dead. Minutes after the suicide bombing, two Palestinians were reported killed in explosions at the Al-Amari refugee camp in Ramallah. In Gaza yesterday, Israeli warplanes bombed a metal factory at the Mughazi refugee camp. Late yesterday, the defense minister announced the cancellation of plans to ease the dire conditions of Palestinians, although these plans were never specified. We're going to go right now to Israel, to Rami Elhanan, who is the father of Smadar Elhanan, who was killed in a suicide bombing September 4th, 1997. She was 14 years old. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rami Elhanan.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Your response to what's happening now, this latest series of attacks and suicide bombings?
Well, the natural response is a response of anger, of frustration, of deep sorrow. It's like living it all over again and again. It's an endless cycle of violence, and it's a horrible thing. It's unbearable.
But given, as you say, this endless cycle of violence and the fact that despite all efforts of the Israeli Defense Forces to occupy and clamp down on so many Palestinian towns on the West Bank, the attacks continue. Are there other Israelis that are beginning to question whether this policy is going to bring them the peace and security that they so desire?
No, I don't think so. I think... Anyone with a little logic in his head should see that there is no military solution to this problem. But the fact is that the two peoples went crazy. And they lost control of events and of themselves. And what is urgently needed now is an outside intervention, I think.
And what do you think that outside intervention should look like?
I think outside intervention should all the civilized countries should stop standing aside, looking at what's happening without doing nothing, gathering forces, and force these two crazy people to sit down and talk. Because there is no other way.
Who are you referring to?
I'm referring to the Europeans. I am referring to the Russians, and mostly I'm referring to the Americans, which not only are they not standing aside, but they are helping Israel, to my opinion, against Israel's best interest.
And among the families of so many of the Israeli victims of these suicide bombings, is there any movement that has developed to begin to bring some rationality to the policies of your government?
I can represent only myself, and I belong to a very small group which is called the Bereaved Families Forum for Peace. And we are about 200 Israeli bereaved families and about 150 Palestinian bereaved families. And we are getting together and we are talking and we are trying to put some sense into those heads who doesn't feel what the price means.
Do you think that the movement that has been developing, especially among young people in Europe and the United States and other countries, to go into the occupied territories and act as observers and international buffers has helped at all in this process?
I don't think it should be the act of volunteers and goodwillers. I think it has to be an action of the democratic nations, the civilized world, not to stand aside like they did 60 years ago during the Holocaust, watching those two peoples killing each other without any mercy. And they should be taking some diplomatic action, very, very severe and harsh diplomatic action, in order to force these crazy people to sit down and talk.
Rami Ohanan, speaking to us from Israel. His daughter was also killed in a suicide bombing several years ago. And finally, speaking of war, a defiant Saddam Hussein yesterday vowed to repel any U.S. attack to topple his regime, as the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, indicated that the U.S. and Britain could launch a military campaign without securing the backing of the United Nations.
I've got to find another tax loophole for those rich donors before Bush's next fundraising dinner.
We're going to need more campaign cash in November. How can I make the Democratic platform even more corporate friendly?
I know.
What if?
Hey, you got Democrat in my Republican.
Hey, you got Republican in my Democrat.
Not much difference, actually.
Yeah, two bland tastes that almost taste the same.
Paid for by billionaires for Bush or Gore. We don't care who you vote for. We've already bought them. Billionairesforbushorgore.com.
Here's the story of a corporation.
You got Republican and my Democrat, the merger, billionaires for Bush and more. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. It's good to see you laugh, Juan.
Yes, Amy. Well, I've just come back from vacation, so I feel a lot more like laughing lately.
Are you reading any good books?
Yes, I just finished Vargas Llosa's book, The Feast of the Goat. Tremendous, tremendous novel about the final days of the group that assassinated the dictator Trujillo, Rafael Trujillo, back in 1961. And actually, it's an amazing recreation of an event that never got a whole lot of coverage here in the United States. And great novel, but also it's an amazing look at the bravery required of people, in particular difficult circumstances under such a dictatorship as the Trujillo regime was, probably one of the most brutal ever to exist in the Western Hemisphere.
Hmm. Well, you're talking about a novel, though you're talking about a novel based on facts. Maybe in the years to come, there'll be a lot of novels based on what's happening in Washington right now around the issue of the corporate crime wave that has swept the nation. House approves tough business reform measure. House Republicans in scramble to act over company fraud. House okays tough action against fraud. Public anger fuels fast response on corporate crime. Just a few of yesterday's headlines from the mainstream media. Republicans in the House scrambling to appease an angry public following a wave of corporate scandals. They're concerned that the public will turn against them in the upcoming congressional elections. And yet the Washington Post reported yesterday House Speaker Dennis Hastert defied the pleas of several rank-and-file Republicans and rejected the Senate's reform bill. The decision gave accounting industry lobbyists more time to press their congressional allies for leniency. Now House GOP leaders are already maneuvering to delay and dilute the Senate's reform bill. So we have two stories about what's going on. The Republicans are acting tough on corporate crime, and the Republicans are, as usual, trying to subvert the Democrats, who are even tougher on corporate crime. But no one in the mainstream media is asking, are the Republicans and Democrats actually very different on this issue? Are they really trying to rein in corporations? Both parties are funded by corporations. According to the nonpartisan group Democracy 21, corporations and business executives have poured a staggering $1 billion in soft money into Washington in the last decade. They gave $636 million to Republicans and $449 million to Democrats. Well, today on Democracy Now!, we're going to have a different kind of discussion. We'll compare the corporate-funded proposals on Capitol Hill. Then we'll broaden the discussion to take a look at some revolutionary proposals that come not from corporate-funded politicians, but from the people. We're going to begin with Damon Silvers, who is Associate General Counsel of the AFL-CIO. Can you talk about the latest bills and legislation proposed on Capitol Hill?
Sure, Amy. What's happening here is that there was a decent bill passed out of the Senate, which combines the accounting and corporate governance proposals that Senator Sarbanes had brought up with some measures that would both increase criminal penalties for people for executives who defraud investors, and would also make it easier for investors to sue to get their money back. That's the Leahy bill. Those two things were put together and passed out of the Senate earlier this week. And in the House, you have a Republican-sponsored proposal called the Oxley bill that was passed some months ago. That's a sham, essentially. It doesn't really do anything. And it was passed at the same time as the House majority, the Republican majority, rejected a bill sponsored by John LaFalce from New York State that was even stronger than the Sarbanes bill. What's happening now is the House Republicans are flailing around trying to figure out whether or not they have the nerve to try to block or delay the Sarbanes bill. And you saw, I think, as you were citing these newspaper headlines, two different takes on it from the House Republicans. There was an effort that really began the day before yesterday on Tuesday to throw up more sort of fake bills and give themselves more cover to stall in the conference committee. And then you saw yesterday an effort to use an arcane thing called the blue slip to block the Sarbanes bill entirely in the House. Then it seemed as though that the Republican leadership in the House couldn't withstand the press on that, and then they started saying, no, we're going to go to conference and get this done within a week. And that generated some of the more positive headlines that you were reading. But underneath that, they then said, oh, but, you know, we have some issues. There's some details we need to work out with the Senate. And one of the details is whether or not the Accounting Oversight Board that the Senate bill creates would have any kind of real teeth to it. The House thinks that really the House Republican leadership thinks it really ought not to. So we may yet see a logjam created by the House Republicans who, as you were saying, have gotten, you know, 2/3 of the corporate money being thrown around in this town, and particularly a lot of it from the accounting industry and Chamber of Commerce. They may yet try to do the bidding of their corporate sponsors, but it's a very tough environment for them to try to do that because the public is so adamant and the mainstream press is so adamant that something like the Sarbanes bill has to get done.
But now, can I ask you, what are the essential differences between the two approaches? Because we're reading in the press, for instance, that the latest Republican version would have even stiffer criminal penalties, but would make it more difficult for shareholders or other people to actually initiate actions or sue. And could you tell us what are some of the essential differences between them, if there are any?
Sure. Well, there are two. Remember, the bill that came out of the Senate has two components. One component is kind of structural reform. The other component deals with punishing people in the courts. I'll start with the punishing part because that's where the Republicans have really tried to make their play. The difference between the Senate bill and the House bills now that the House rushed through this bill on Tuesday to add a punishment piece to their bill, which they didn't even have before Tuesday. The difference is, as you note, that the spin doctors among the House Republicans have added on lengthening the prison terms off of where the Senate bill is. They do that because they know that in fact it's a very, very rare day in America when a corporate executive goes to prison. And so whether the prison terms are 10 years or 25 years, their corporate clients don't really care. What they do care about a great deal is all the mechanisms that the Senate bill has in it to make it as you say, more easy for investors to get their money back and to create some real accountability. Senate bill has a whistleblower protection measure in it, which is a real thing that would help change corporate America. And it has a provision that makes it possible for investors to sue for frauds that have gone on over a period of 5 years, as opposed to current law, which is 3 years. Makes a big difference in a case like Enron, where you get a long period of fraud. Those things are not in the House bill. On the structural reform side, as I said, the House bill, the Oxley bill, is essentially empty. There's really very little in it. The Senate bill basically bars almost all consulting done by audit firms, which is the key factor that Arthur Levitt and others identified as being the sort of the source of why these audit firms have become so such a pushover in relation to accounting fraud by their clients. It's got that, and secondly, it's got a whole new body set up with independent funding to oversee the accounting industry, a body that doesn't exist today. And the accounting industry, the big firms hate that. And then finally, it's got corporate governance provisions that do things that, like, require that the audit committee of every public corporation be completely independent of the management of that company. CEOs hate that. And the House bill has none of those provisions. Now, I will say that, you know, these are substantive provisions, which is why the AFL-CIO supports this bill. However, you know, this is not enough, right? There are a whole set of measures that valiant efforts were made last week to get onto the Sarbanes bill that would really have deepened the reform that we need now. Measures like proper accounting for stock options that Senators McCain and Levin were trying to move forward, ending the civil immunity that that lawyers and accountants enjoy for aiding and abetting securities fraud that Senators Shelby and Durbin were trying to move forward. And most importantly, a measure that we favored very strongly, but we couldn't really get on anything, that would have made it possible for worker pension funds to be able to nominate and run our candidates for corporate boards. And those ideas sort of just didn't get into the mix.
If I can just interrupt you for a second, we'd like to bring in Richard Grossman, who is the co-founder of Corporations Law and Democracy. He joins us by phone and to ask him what your sense is of these. He's joining us by phone from Massachusetts. What your sense is of the of these two bills? Are there essential differences between them, and are they going? Will either of them be effective in accomplishing substantive change on this issue?
I'm actually talking from New Hampshire.
Oh, I'm sorry, New Hampshire.
I think they're probably nice, but they're fundamentally irrelevant. We're not facing an accounting crisis. We're not facing a corporate crime crisis. We're really in a constitutional crisis. There's a whole different discussion going on around the country among people and communities who have for decades and decades now been resisting corporate assaults on their communities, been resisting corporate denial of rights of workers, been fundamentally denying, through their accumulated power and wealth, denying the American people our fundamental right to govern ourselves. That's a discussion, and it's been very visible. You know, Seattle, what happened in Seattle was not obscured. The struggles against the multilateral agencies like the World Bank and the IMF and the WTO, the struggles against NAFTA and Fast Track, and then all the struggles, you know, whether it's against chemical manufacturing and pollution and toxic dumps and all kinds of mining. I mean, all the enormous assaults that corporations and the people behind corporations have been perpetrating on the American people those have not just gone by unnoticed. People are resisting, and what they are talking now about is the enormous power that that the people running corporations wield under law, that they have been able to wield the Constitution against the American people. I mean, corporations have First Amendment, they have due process, they have equal protection, and they're using the rule of law and our own government against the American people. So that if people in a municipality or a state wanted even to try to pass a law to get the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and all these corporate lobbyists out of our legislatures and out of our public face, we can't do it because the law of the land is that the corporations have free speech, constitutional privilege, and we can't interfere.
Richard Grossman, we're going to ask you what the alternative is when we come back from our break. Richard Grossman, co-founder of the Project on Corporations Law and Democracy, known as POCLAD. Damon Silver's with us, General Counsel, Associate General Counsel of the AFL-CIO. And we'll have some other guests as well when we return here on Democracy Now!
I say it one more time to emphasize the meaning of my rhyme. To rise above all the dirt and grime at the right spice, at the right time. The Constitution, are we part of the solution? Or are we part of the pollution? Sitting by and wondering why things ain't the way we like to find them to be for you and for me. The people over there and the ones in between. Check our habitation. Are we a peace-loving nation? Peace-loving nation. I have a reasonable doubt. I think I just spell it out. There's no need to scream or to shout. The NRA just bought a man's soul. Then he jumps up and shouts, gun control. The government say that killing's a sin. Unless you kill a murderer with a lethal syringe. So I ask again, are we peace lovers then? Peace lovers then. Some of them slang guns when they 6 years old. Some of them end up in some 6 foot hole. This whole damn place into lost control. So I raise my voice before I lose my soul. Bam, bam. Rock the nation.
Rock the Nation, Michael Franti and Spearhead here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Some of the headlines about corporations and corporate irresponsibility today involve, one, during the market boom, a handful of top executives at telecommunications companies received big allotments of hot new stocks from Solomon Smith Barney, according to a former broker who's filed a lawsuit accusing the firm of unfair business practices. Jack Grubman, the firm's star analyst covering these businesses, played a central role in deciding which executives got how many shares, this according to the broker in an interview with the New York Times. Then Harvey Pitt, the embattled head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, says the expiration of ethics restrictions that have bound him during his first year in office, he would play, now that they're gone, he'll play a direct role in enforcement cases involving companies and accounting firms that were once his law clients. And Thomas White, the U.S. Army Secretary, under investigation for his actions as a former Enron executive, will tell congressional investigators today that he had no knowledge of Enron's questionable trading practices when the company manipulated electricity prices during the California energy crisis last year. We're talking about corporate power, and we're talking about legislation. What is the solution? Our guest, Damon Silver, Associate General Counsel of the AFL-CIO, and Richard Grossman, co-founder of the Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. You talked about how corporations under law in this country are treated as people with freedom of speech, etc. So what should they be treated as?
They should be treated as subordinate entities that are simply creatures of law, and not as the political arm of the wealthy class, which is what they're treated as. They're currently governing institutions. If you go back and look at some of the charters that the English king gave to the corporations that he formed to settle America, they were charged to plant and rule and govern. And that's fundamentally what corporations have created themselves to be. And so the problem is with our public officials. I mean, we can't get corporate leaders to act more ethically or more responsibly when it is our public officials that are basically giving away the power, the rights of the American people to govern to these private entities. What we have is a systematized, institutionalized private tyranny which wields the law of the land against us. So that's what we have to address. And as long as the focus of the corporate press and the corporate Congress is on corporate what they call corporate crimes and frauds, and we're not talking, you know, the words that people in other generations use, like usurpation and fundamental denial of rights, and focusing on our public officials who are the ones who are responsible for this. I mean, our state legislators write the state corporate codes. They charter the corporations. And that our state legislators and state's attorney generals have not thrown themselves into this mess is a dereliction of duty. They are responsible. They have unleashed these corporations upon us, and we have to go after them. And the more we spend time playing around with these corporate executives, the more we're not going to the heart, which is the fact that we have a system of corporate tyranny that is enabled by the politicians who basically have the same values as these corporate leaders.
Well, Richard Grossman, we're also joined by Bob Monks, founder of Institutional Shareholder Services and Lens Investment Management, a well-known Republican shareholder activist. Also, Robert Hinckley is with us, who is a former lawyer for the New York firm Skadden Arps for many years, 22 years, left the partnership to promote a legally enforceable code of corporate citizenship. But let's start with Bob Monks.
Yes, Mr. Monks, you've heard now Richard Grossman with his perspective and Damon Silvers of the AFL-CIO analyzing the bills. What's your take on the current legislation, or if you'd like to comment on some of the remarks of Mr. Grossman?
I'm speaking from Maine, and in the background you can hear the ocean, and things seem a little different here than they do in other locations, even in next door New Hampshire. Richard Grossman is a great man, and he has long carried the lonely battle to get people to face up to the implications of corporatism. I think what I took from the first two speakers was a general agreement that they don't think very much of the current legislation. Damon Silvers said, in effect, that all the talk about corporate increased sanctions is just eyewash, which it is. I mean, the number of people who get locked up for corporate crimes are, you can count in the fingers of one hand, although I did when I was a kid living in western Massachusetts. The father of one of my friends was in GE and the GE electric conspiracy in the 50s, and there was a toothbrush day. He actually did go, and as a kid, I remember my friend's father, who was a leader of the community, going to jail, but I don't remember anybody since. My own view is that the current spate of legislative enthusiasm is the kind of thing that ultimately makes people cynical about government. Possibly the provisions for an accounting regulatory agency in time will be thought of as being useful, but even about that, I really would have to declaim. I just want to talk a little bit about another approach to this. Basically, the current reform proposals are talking about what I call the supply side of corporate governance, what companies, directors, and auditors must do. But none of this will work unless we focus on the demand side, what shareholders can and must do. I mean, institutional shareholders manage the largest accumulation of investment capital ever assembled, and of course, critical here is the AFL-CIO, who in the last two or three years under Bill Patterson have actually begun to provide some real leadership here. One looks to them for more of that and the same. You know, in the Hewlett-Packard compact merger case, it is perfectly clear that the action of Deutsche Asset Management in that case violated the ERISA, that the undertaking under ERISA for trustees of funds to act exclusively for the benefit of the plan participants was violated there because Deutsche took a fee from Hewlett-Packard in order to vote their shares. Now, unfortunately, this subject never came up. Why didn't it come up? It came up because the SEC and the Labor Department have never enforced the law. I mean, again and again and again we see that the beneficiaries of pension funds have lost billions of dollars. Ted Kennedy had a terrific caption the other day when he was in the Senate floor. You know, the $1 billion that was taken out by executives of Enron and the $1 billion that was lost by their 401k plans. This is not just a coincidence. It is a history of non-enforcement. There has not been enforcement of the obligation of mutual funds to participate for the benefit of their shareholders, or for pension plans to try to protect the rights of the pensioners. I don't understand why this hasn't happened. I used to have the job in the Reagan administration of running the pension system, and I brought a lawsuit against Carter Hawley Hale in those days. And for a variety of reasons that are understandable, the administration, you know, withdrew my suit, and that was 20 years ago, and no one's brought one since. If you really want to get some action here, get the Labor Department and get the SEC to start enforcing the obligation of investment companies and pension funds to act in the interest of their beneficiaries, and then you'll see something happen.
But clearly that would require then the administration, which is perhaps one of the administrations most identified with corporate support in U.S. history, to act, not the Congress. Can we bring in Damon Silvers on this whole issue of what the AFL-CIO has been doing? Clearly, some of the biggest institutional investors are pension funds such as the California, such as CalPERS or the New York State Teachers Retirement Fund. What have you been doing on this front of shareholder activism?
Well, I think you know, as Bob kindly put it, we've been trying to mobilize worker capital to protect pension fund participants' interests here. I mean, we've done things just in the last few months, like when Lockheed Martin wanted to re-elect an Enron director, someone who had been on the board of Enron and been on the Enron some of the committees involved in the frauds at Enron. Lockheed Martin thought they'd make a great director at Lockheed Martin. They tried to re-elect this individual, Frank Savage, and we fought that. Our funds fought that. Funds like CalPERS, that are public pension funds that represent have a lot of union members participating in them, they joined us in fighting that. But I think, you know, as Bob was saying, though, you know, we got 35% of the public shareholders of Lockheed Martin to vote against management nominated director. Now, why was it that 65% of Lockheed Martin stock was voted for an Enron director this year after everything we know about Enron? The answer is that two mutual funds, Fidelity and Janus, thought that it was in the interest of their investors to re-elect an Enron director. The only thing about it was they didn't tell anybody they were doing it. We figured it out by looking at the math of the vote, but they don't disclose to their investors what they're doing. And what they're doing is propping up, you know, the worst corporate practices that are going on here, as Bob Bunks was saying. The labor movement, our pension funds and the pension funds that workers participate in, that public agencies sponsor and so forth, we are trying to mobilize that capital to change corporate America. And not just, by the way, along the sort of governance issues that I was just alluding to, like, you know, whether or not you want to have an Enron director, sort of very basic stuff. But we have a view of how corporations should behave, right, that I think is best embodied, for example, in a shareholder proposal that some workers brought at General Electric, saying, you know, shouldn't General Electric worldwide abide by the International Labor Organization's core labor rights standards? Doesn't that make sense on every level for our company? You know, we don't want to be associated with child labor and slavery. And we've organized the big money cloud of pension funds behind that long-term responsible view of how you generate value. That's our agenda.
Well, yeah. That brings us to Robert Hinckley, a longtime corporate lawyer with Skadden Arps, who is promoting a single amendment. Can you talk about what that is?
Sure. The problem, I say, with corporations is that we've devoted them purely to their own self-interest. We tend to forget that corporations would not exist if there were not a corporate law in every state in the country and every OECD nation that says the duty of corporate directors is to make money for shareholders. And this duty basically creates the purpose of the corporation, and it's something that everybody understands from the minute they enter a door, either as a director or a manager or an employee. Their job is to help the corporation make money. My point is that dedicating the corporation to self-interest in this way leaves the corporation without a conscience. And corporations do a number of things that are within the law but are unethical or immoral. President Bush this week in his speech to Wall Street said, in the long run, there's no capitalism without conscience. And we see our corporations despoiling the environment, violating human rights and the dignity of their employees, endangering the public health and safety with dangerous or untested products, damaging the welfare of our communities, all in ways which often are totally legal. But there's not much conscience in any of that. In fact, I think it's more indicative of an absence of conscience than it is a presence. But what people tend to forget is that the corporate law is the people's law. Our representatives in the state legislatures have enacted this law. They change it regularly from time to time, and we could change it again to change the purpose of the corporation. And what I am suggesting is that the purpose of the corporation, leave in the profit motive, should still be to make money for shareholders, but add 26 words, but not at the expense of the environment, human rights, the public health or safety, the dignity of employees, or the welfare of the communities in which they operate. And then back this duty to these five elements of the public interest with the ability of the public to bring lawsuits against corporations and their corporate directors if they violate these duties, much the same way that shareholders have the right to sue directors and the corporation if they violate the duties to make profits for shareholders. So what I'm talking about basically is an evolution of the corporation from being dedicated totally to self-interest to balancing it with interest, balancing it with duties to the public interest. And I think this is something that everybody understands and can sign on to. It makes no sense to have our most powerful citizens, as Richard Grossman points out, have all the rights of citizenship and none of the obligations of citizenship. John Ralston Saul, the Canadian philosopher, has said that when a society's most powerful interests are dedicated totally to the pursuit of their own interests, that society's in trouble. And I think that's what we have in this country. Our most powerful interests are the corporate interests, and by law, they are dedicated solely to the pursuit of their own interests.
Well, I'd like to ask Richard Grossman to respond whether he thinks that the kind of amendment that Robert Hinckley is suggesting would go in any direction in terms of curtailing some of the powers that he's concerned about that corporations have assumed.
Well, I appreciate Bob's pointing us in the direction of the state corporate codes, because I think that's a very important arena that we need to get into. I don't think that changing those words would do very much. Corporations are political entities. It's the power that they wield to make the law. Bob and other people today have said most of what these corporations have been doing that are upsetting people and outraging people have been legal. That's because they have been writing the laws. They have been the ones interpreting the Constitution. You know, for example, go back to the pension funds. That under the Taft-Hartley law, workers' unions cannot control more than 50% of their pension funds. So you end up, you know, running all around trying to mobilize because the law, in fact, limits the rights of workers to control their own money. Just like in most environmental and workplace health laws, legalize corporations pouring out, cancer-causing poisons into the air and the water and people's lungs. You know, the big plundering took place well before 2001 and the revelations about Enron. If you go back just to 1979 to 1989, the portion of the nation's wealth held by the top 1% nearly doubled from 22% to 32% to 39%. The purpose of the corporation is to concentrate wealth, to vacuum up wealth from workers, from the American people, to plunder the countryside, and to do it all under the cover of the rule of law, and to use the government to prevent us from doing anything significant, and to having us, you know, we have to play around between the Republican bill and the Democratic bill on stock options or on iShares, you know, clearer iShares for the accountants. When we're not talking about stripping corporations of their claim to any constitutional rights, we're not talking about putting a time limit on the existence of corporations, as used to be the case. They're chartered for 10 or 20 years. We're not talking about using the state corporate codes to make corporations fundamentally subordinate to elected officials, to the people, so that corporations cannot wield the power against us. We're not even talking about making shareholders liable for what they're doing. It used to be, frankly, for the first 100 years, that shareholders were liable for the debts and harms of the corporations, and particularly in many states, there were constitutional amendments that required the shareholders to pay for the workers when the company went bankrupt. I think, you know, we're watching this bankruptcy now in Enron. It's insane, because I suspect most people think bankruptcy is about justice, but bankruptcy is about affirming the rule of law so that lenders in the future will be confident that they're going to get their money back when whoever screws up the next time. So it's only the preferred lenders and the secured lenders that are going to get anything back here, and the workers are getting screwed. The common stock shareholders of Enron.
Well, if I can interrupt you right there, because we've got about a minute left, I'd like to get Bob Monks to give his perspective on these two views. Richard Grossman wants radical surgery. Robert Hinckley wants major reform in state corporate codes. Well, what's your take on the solution?
My take is that if we actually lived in an ideal world and we took the current crisis and did the best possible thing we could do, the Supreme Court decision giving citizenship to corporations would be repealed. That is the single great evil that we have to deal with. Unfortunately, underlies everything, as Richard Grossman said. As Mr. Hinckley said, I believe that the question really is what does optimizing value mean? And in my own case, what I've tried to do is to deal with almost the same kind of solution that he has, only to talk about a more spacious view of value and talking about it as being something that is a holistic sense, as the owners are pensioners who are going to retire in 20 years, and what they want is not only money's worth, but they also want a clean society, a civil society, a decent society in which to retire. So in this past year, I brought a resolution at Exxon Corporation that was simply trying under our pathetic SEC laws to get the management to take account of global warming. And in my view, that is part of the long-term value. So I get to the same place Mr. Hinckley does. At the same time, I understand that what my friend Richard Grossman is saying, that is the problem. I mean, until we deal with the atrocity of corporations having constitutionally guaranteed rights, we'll never get fair election laws, we'll never really deal with the scope of the problem. And it's just as simple as getting five people on the Supreme Court to change their mind.
Bob Monks, I want to thank you for being with us as that wraps up our discussion just for today. Founder of Institutional Shareholder Services, well-known Republican shareholder activist, Robert Hinckley, former Skadden Arps corporate lawyer, now promoting a legally enforceable code of corporate citizenship. Richard Grossman is co-founder of the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And Damon Silvers, Associate General Counsel of the AFL-CIO. When we come back, it's not only workers in the United States who are concerned about losing their pensions. In China, thousands today are protesting, and more than half of state employees there, it is believed, have been sacked over the last few years. Stay with us. Zhang Yu removes his armor from the Hua Xia Chamber Ensemble. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Yes, workers in the U.S., not the only ones seeing their pensions disappear. As many as 2,000 former workers from a closed brick and tile factory in the Chinese province of Inner Mongolia have clashed with police. Hundreds are occupying the factory, demanding pension benefits. There have been hundreds of such disputes in China in recent years. As China moves toward a market economy, millions of workers are being laid off, their pension funds disappearing, leaving workers with nothing in a society in which people are increasingly being forced to fend for themselves. Tonight, PBS is premiering a new film about China by filmmaker John Alpert, who runs Downtown Community Television, where we're based here in Chinatown in downtown Manhattan. John Alpert recently returned from a trip to China, where almost his entire film crew was arrested. Well, you're not going to learn that in the film, and we're going to talk about John about the film. But we're going to start with a clip of an interview I did with Jiang Shui-Chin, who is the Chinese-Canadian journalist who worked with John on the film in China. He came back to New York last month after being deported from China, as he was trying to cover labor unrest in northeast China. He describes his experience.
When I got there, we had a tip. We had a news tip that there would be a large worker demonstration that day. But when I got there to the square, I found it to be extremely peaceful. There were about 200 workers there, and they were old and retired. And they went there every day to sit and stand peacefully outside the big oil management company, which is the de facto power in that city. Mm-hmm. So that tower was a huge, large white building. And it sort of was like a magnet attracting disgruntled workers from all over the city. But they were just sitting there. They weren't chanting slogans. They were just standing there. And I got caught because the government has lots of spies within the workers, because the police knows who goes every day. And because they were over 40 and all very old, I stood out, obviously. So the secret police jumped me. And I sort of resisted, so they beat me up, and they threw me in a car, and we drove to the police station.
Were you filming this demonstration?
I was filming this demonstration, yes.
How?
Well, filming demonstration in China is illegal because the government doesn't want to give the impression that the country is unstable. So the government takes extreme measures to keep this secret, despite the fact that it's not a violent protest. It's a peaceful protest. Lots of journalists who have tried to take photos, try to interview the workers, have been arrested and deported from that region. So I use hidden glasses camera supplied by the documentary crew. But they didn't arrest me because I had those glasses. They arrested me because I stood out, and they thought that I might be a foreign reporter. Mm-hmm.
So they held you for how long?
They held me for 48 hours.
Uh-huh. Did they hurt you?
Well, I was beating up at first, but after that, they were fairly nice to me. But they were nice to me because they knew that I was a Western journalist. They also had another worker that day that I interviewed. They arrested that worker, and they were screaming and threatening him, and I could hear it in the other room.
How has the behavior of the police changed in the 2 years that you've been covering China from inside?
I think that the police are more competent. I think that the police are getting better at their jobs. I became fairly decent friends with the police because I spent 48 hours with them, and these were decent people, and they thought that they were just doing their job, and they told me some very interesting things. Over the past 2 years, because the Communist Party has become more and more afraid of social unrest, the Communist Party has been investing lots of money into the police, the secret police, and the military apparatus. So there are more people working for them, and the people are better compensated. So they do a better job of keeping track of unrest. One thing that they told me that startled me was the number of police informants they have. For example, in March, when about 10,000 or 20,000 workers took the streets, they told me that they had 20% of those workers were police informants. There was one police informant keeping track of four or five workers. So they knew everyone in that demonstration. So if they could arrest any of the leaders, any of the more vocal workers.
So what about this increasingly repressive police apparatus at the time when the country George Bush is talking about it becoming more capitalist, has entered the World Trade Organization?
Mm-hmm. I think that the U.S. has always had a problem of perceiving China the way it once perceived China. And I think that the Chinese government has done a wonderful job of repressing the sort of bad news about China's economic reforms. I think that there's a side of China. There's one very small part of China that gets reported over and over again, just because this part, and these are the English-speaking intellectuals that have really benefited from Deng Xiaoping's economic reforms. They're the ones that are really happy with what's going on. And they may be like 5 or 10% of the population. They can speak English. They're very open. Open, and they're very opinionated. So whenever foreign journalists go into China, whenever policymakers go into China, these are the people they meet, and these are the people that they talk to. So they get a very narrow perception of what China is. And basically, there's a refrain, and this is what Americans get told over and over again. China may have problems, but these problems are getting less and less. China is much better than what it was 20 years ago. And now with China entering WTO, rule of law will start coming into the country.
This is what they say.
This is what they say. And corporate America also says this because corporate America wants to do business in China.
Keep it going. It's a reporter who's been on the ground for several years now.
I mean, I think that it's unfortunate that the people who have the power of eloquence, the people who are educated, can control the discourse of what's happening in China, because it's a very distorted view. I've spent 2 years in China, and I've spent a lot of time interviewing the peasants, the workers, the ordinary people. And because I spent a lot of time with them, I was able to win their trust, and they were able to, and they really confided in me what was really going on. And my perception of China is that it's no more than a fascist kleptocracy, probably no more than what's happening in Russia, in Latin America, in the Philippines. But I'm into a lesser to degree. The rich are plundering the state resources and state assets.
And do you think the opening of markets is accelerating the corruption and the repression?
I think that the rich will find a way to plunder resources at a more efficient rate now that China has access to all these foreign markets.
Zhang Shuiqin was deported from China last month. He was one of the people who worked on the film that's airing on PBS tonight, To Have and Have Not. The filmmaker on that project, John Alpert, joins us. Welcome, John. So we don't hear about it in the film, but he and other members of your crew were arrested in trying to do this and cover what's happening in China. Can you talk about the point of tonight's film?
The point of tonight's film was to try and show the people who have benefited from the economic reform, and there are people who have benefited. I mean, the wealth that some people have accumulated is astronomical, but it's this part of the society. We tried very much to...
For our radio listeners, he just gave a very little tiny fraction.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. I'm a television person. The people who have suffered would be the peasants, 800 million of them. Their economic future does not look good. And the workers in the state-owned companies who are losing their jobs, 20 million a year, it doesn't look good. We didn't do a good job covering that because the Chinese government prevented us from doing it. We wanted to, and PBS very much wanted to include that on the program. It was basically our failure. The Chinese government and my crew engaged in battle. They certainly battled us to a draw. Maybe they even won that because they arrested Zhang. Two other people were held at a local police station until the U.S. Embassy got on the phone and read the Riot Act. We were followed. People who we talked to were visited by the secret police, told not to speak to us, or were asked to spy. It was tough.
Now, this film is appearing in a new PBS series. Can you tell us a little bit about what that series is intending to do?
I think in television in general tends to redline everything outside the borders of the United States. So you very seldom see any documentaries about foreign countries. And this is an attempt by PBS to fix that. Who knows how it's going to turn out? Our show is the second show. The first one was about Saddam Hussein and the use of chemical agents in Iraq. Next week it's Chechnya. They're doing something on the Argentinian economy. I'm rooting for this series to be a good series. I'm very thankful that they made us a part of it because we've been blacklisted for many years by PBS, and the fact that we're included in this program certainly makes me happy. They wanted us to do a good job. I'm hoping that this series becomes successful.
You may not be able to comment on this, John, but I was concerned that a series called Wide Angle, which is really billed as something that is looking journalist views of the world, and very important to have that view of the international perspective, is hosted by, there are two hosts, not tonight's host for your program, but James Rubin, the former State Department spokesperson.
Right.
I get concerned when public television starts to look like state television. And last week's program was all these unnamed sources that are shrouded talking about Saddam's ultimate solution. Yes, the administration is pushing for a bombing of Iraq, and it looked like that's what it was pushing for. And now after the program tonight, which is a very interesting program, yours, it's an interview with Charlene Barshefsky, who wants to open up China to U.S. investment. It seems to be just following the administration, Democrat and Republicans, line to have James Rubin, he's a new journalist that's coming on the scene now.
He's competing with Stephanopoulos over at ABC.
Well, I think there's a couple of things at work. First of all, PBS is mainstream media, and they want to be noticed in Washington. They want to be able to get heavyweight people to be the guests on the program. And Mr. Rubin is connected to this circle of people. He certainly would help to get them attention in Washington. So I think it's an attempt to do that. I can speak for the documentary part. Nobody was putting a bit in my mouth. The narration on the program is written by me. The edits are my edits. If the program's bad, it's my fault.
Let's take a listen. Just a clip of the film that is airing tonight on PBS, To Have and Have Not. It is made by filmmaker John Alpert.
For centuries, peasants like Duan Ji's parents have been poor. Now the situation in the countryside is expected to get worse. China's entry into the WTO will increase food imports, and the Chinese government officially estimates that 20 million farm jobs will be lost. Life's getting harder for peasants like Mr. Xu.
That's my land.
This
is a state allocated based on the number of family members. This year, the most profitable crop are bitter melon and eggplant. We're going to Mr. Xu's house. You can see it's quite a humble house, and he doesn't have much money. This is my mother.
She's
70 years old. This is where they store the grain. The government is no longer giving good prices for the rice they grow. At the same time, they're loading up with all kinds of taxes. He's saying that you can't really survive as a rice farmer anymore. Some people have to work periodically in the city to get some laboring job.
Mr. Xu's son left the farm by joining the army. It's one of the only ways to get around the laws that forbid farmers from leaving their village. But all over rural China, it's hard to find any young people. They've secretly slipped off to the cities because that's where the jobs are. Fifteen percent of China's rural peasants have migrated to urban areas where they live like illegal aliens in their own country. The pay is low, working conditions are primitive, but it's better than life in the countryside.
I came in March to Beijing.
Oh yeah? Do you like it?
你喜欢北京吗?
Uh-huh.
I like Beijing.
Uh-huh. Mm. What is this here that you're building?
He's going to kindergarten.
Or kindergarten?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And how much does he get paid?
你每月能赚多少钱呢? I make $60-$70 a month.
Uh-huh. Where do you come from?
I'm from Hebei province.
Hebei province.
Hebei province.
Hebei province. Hebei province.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Seems like there's nobody left in Hebei, right?
To Have and Have Not. A film that will air on PBS's Wide Angle tonight. John Alpert, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate
it. We'll play the full interview with Jiang Shijian later in the week or next week. That does it for the program. You can go to our website to look for information, www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Michael Yeh, Anthony Reparation Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Some people just can't stand